Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
You have to understand and hear how it sounds like the administration might be hiding something.
You've watched him debate many times. What do you think are his debate strengths?
Are you convinced that there will be a difference showing up in the polls in the coming days?
Tough-sounding questions, intense live performances, both hallmarks of TV news. Few know them better than Jessica Yellen, formerly of MSNBC, ABC News, and CNN. Now comes Savage News, Yellen's first novel, a lacerating take on television news. Think Katie Tour by way of Carl Hiaasen, a business driven by brand rather than mission. Glitz over journalism, hair over history, and sexual harassment as a way of life. This hour on Point, Jessica Yellen's savage, satiric take on TV news. So we'll talk this hour about TV news, about journalism, politics, and the moment we're living in. We want you to join us, share your thoughts and your questions for former TV news star and correspondent Jessica Yellen. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and the Facebooks at On Point Radio. Joining me here in the studio in New York City, Jessica Yellen. She's an Emmy Award-winning political journalist, former chief CNN White House correspondent. She currently runs the digital venture News Not Noise, explaining the news on Instagram, and we'll be talking about that later in the show, too. Her new book, however, Savage News, is, as I said, a satiric novel about an ambitious female correspondent with aspirations of rising to become the top White House reporter at a leading cable news network. Sounds a little familiar. Jessica, it should also sound familiar to you. She's been a frequent guest host for On Point, a friend of the show in word and deed. Jessica, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It is so fun to be here. That was amazing.
It's awesome. I've known Jessica for some years as a reporter and a human being. Pretty excellent on both counts. Why don't you start by giving us a little taste of your heroine and of your novel, Natalie Savage, no relation to Jessica Savage, the former anchor in the 70s and 80s. But nonetheless, Natalie Savage herself is the key figure, something of a stand-in for you, I imagine.
There's a lot of Natalie in me and a lot of me in Natalie. It's the way I put it.
I like it. So let's start with a reading. It's the first one we lined up for you. In this, I think it's fair to say Natalie Savage was no stranger to mild disapproval from her bosses at the network. She thought that was mostly because her hairstyle wasn't what they wanted, and it was only after a different conversation that she was urged to be something other than her true self.
Okay, I'll do this reading. Her boss is named Bib. "It is well," Bib paused. "It's you. I worry you're a little too outside the lines." Bib tilted her head. "What are you? What's your thing?" Natalie frowned, speechless. "See, even you aren't sure. That's a problem," Bib said. "What should I be?" Natalie asked, genuinely uncertain. "We need you to be very authentic," Bib said. "Viewers love authenticity, Hal," her deputy bureau chief said, nodding enthusiastically. Were they serious? Authenticity, like relatability, was one of those words news managers love to throw around without assigning it a meaning. "So are you saying I should be more myself on air, show more personality?" Natalie asked, trying to sound open-minded. "No," Hal shook his head violently with a look that said, "Eek, not that, anything but you." "More authentic," Bib repeated, as if it were a tonal language. "Develop something you're known for, a texture and personality that is uniquely your own, a character to make viewers want to know you and know about you." "What about the news? Isn't the point that viewers want to know about the news?" Natalie wondered, but managed not to say.
So that's the first reading we've had from the text. Natalie Savage, something of a stand-in. What about the news? Now, this story is obviously a hyper-realized version of a cable news network, but not so very distant from the way it works, right? How much does this reflect how life is actually lived at a cable channel or a television news network generally?
So my goal in writing this was to give people a glimpse of what it is like to be on this side of the camera and to show people what goes into the daily work of journalism that's not of TV journalism that's not what you expect. And so a lot of the stories are either things that happened to me, happened to my friends, are known in the industry, and then slightly heightened because it's a satire and to make it a fun story. So there are things like I'm getting emails now that it's out from some reporter friends going, oh my God, that happened to me too. That's fun. But some of the stories are over the top.
Well, so there was one time I remember being on a street in D.C. one evening and you told me
I'm scared. What did I do?
No, this was – and by the way, I should point out this was early back then. I think you were doing early hits for whichever network you were working for at the time. And you said something like, you know, I just worked hard to break a story. And I break this story and I get there and I have to wake up early and I do this. And I feel like I'm really advancing the ball. And I finally get a call from like a senior and executive vice president. And she says, I want to talk to you about that story. And I'm so pumped. And she says – could you deal with the fact that one side of your hair is about an eighth or a quarter of an inch longer than the other? Could you just take that up a notch?
It's true.
And that appeared in like page 20 or 30 of your book, right?
It's true.
So how much is – you know, people joke about the superficiality, the blow – you know, drying hair. How much of that is really life as it's lived? How many conversations happen in that regard?
So it was funny. When I was a young reporter – I mean – it happened a lot. And I was surprised by it. You know, I've done interviews now around the book, which, by the way, is the craziest thing to be on this side of the interview scenario after being a reporter all this time. And people say you couldn't have been surprised that they would care about your appearance. You're on TV. And the truth is, I was surprised by how important it was. And not just what you'd get from management, which was always about the hair, but what you pick up from each other. Like, everybody's wearing jewel tones, so we're going to wear jewel tones. Everybody's going sleeveless. This is part of, you know, you're trying to cover the White House. You never want to be wrong. You always want to advance the ball. And you have to worry about the hair and the jewel tones.
It's quite a balance. We have some clips, a couple of clips anyway. I have a couple of interviews you did just to give a little texture of what life actually is like, right, as a reporter. So there was one in which, if I recall correctly, back 2012, you know, this was a time at which people were saying, gosh, Obama, you know, has lost Congress, but, you know, or at least lost this, which did he lose first in 2010? The House.
Yeah.
But, you know, he'd do better if he just rubbed shoulders more. He'd do better if he just used the human touch, get legislation passed, spend more time on the golf course, spend more time breaking bread or getting a beer. But Obama, my sense is, explicitly linked that to the question that he was the father of two young girls who happened to live in the White House. Here in 2012, you asked Obama about that balance in an interview ahead of the presidential elections.
If you're reelected, your girls will be older. They'll probably have their own weekend plans. They might not want to hang out with mom and dad.
It's already starting to happen. Yeah.
Do you think you might do more outreach of what you call backslapping with members of Congress?
What were you trying to get at there? Why was this important to explore?
So that it's interesting you chose that clip. So that was a interview I got with the president for a documentary we were doing ahead of the election. And it was a whole – I think we called it Obama Revealed or something, and kind of a take on his first term. And the one of the big knocks on him was that he did not have strong enough relationships with Congress. And, you know, in D.C., the theory is part of developing political alliances involves social alliances and that you need to spend time with other people. Relationships make business work. Relationships make politics work. And that he wouldn't engage in that. He was too isolated in the White House was the critique. And so I was trying to tease this out as part of this documentary. And was he a very chilly person or was there another reason he wasn't engaging with Congress? Personally, I found that to be an unsatisfactory answer. Like, okay, you have two daughters, but you decided to run for president. So now you have to do outreach to Congress. But that was in a different era. It's so different now.
Well, so there are two things that strike me. One is that as from a political point of view, you know, if you look at all these political pundits and political scientists that you guys have on – you guys, yeah, that CNN and others have on now and used to have on then, when they're not just simply having partisan hacks on, right? You know, they'll say, well, we're in actually a much more polarized age. So the idea that Tip O'Neill, then the Democratic Speaker of the House, and Ronald Reagan, the Republican president, would get together and hash things out together, it's just much less likely to happen because both of them tend to get punished by their bases when they try. You know, there's a reason why House speakers tend to have a relatively short lifespan these days, right?
Yes.
The second thing is, in listening to that interview, it sounded to me as though you were trying to get to Obama's true self. Mm-hmm. When you read that rating earlier about authenticity, what's wrong with – if there's a performative nature of television, what's wrong with the idea of an executive saying we want you to be the authentic you?
Oh, that's interesting. Because, A, there's nothing wrong. But it's not – authentic means who are you really? Show that. And that's not what authentic means in TV land.
So what does it mean in TV?
Authentic means have a thing. What's your trademark quality? I mean, do you have a sign-off that's your standard sign-off? Is there a question you always ask in every interview? Do you have a particular look? Is it glasses? Is it smart? It's like a branding thing. And so when you're trying – like when your whole brain is filled with Washington political news and you want to break those stories and then someone's like, what's your brand? It's just – it's jarring. But so the two terms you always hear in TV land are authenticity and relatability. And it just means do things that make people like you.
The amazing thing is it seems as though they cut against each other, because anytime somebody is to thine own self true, they say, well, what the heck are you doing? Where's the smoky eyes? Where's the eyelash extensions? Why is your hair getting a little wavy or getting a little fluffy in the humidity of Miami?
And one of the challenges is smile more. We want people like people who smile, which was
men
hard.
And women or just women?
I mean, I think it happens more with women. Mm-hmm. And I remember being told that while I was constantly covering the Iraq War. And
good Lord.
It was so – you're like, where am I supposed to smile? So I learned smile as they're introducing you. So you're nodding and smiling. And then the minute you get to the content, you go serious. But those are sort of things you have to add into your repertoire.
It's one of these things where it just strikes me that authenticity – what you're saying is authenticity is deeply inauthentic. They're saying find a thing that you can use as totemically to represent you. Find a trademark. Find a shtick.
It's TV. Yes, it's TV. And so that's what you have to realize is part of this is producing a show. And so
– and that's okay.
It is what it is. And if you're in that, you have to find the way to win in that and make it work for you.
We're discussing the fact and the fiction of covering Washington politics and the White House. It is a book replete with a president who has shady business deals, a foreign-born first lady, a crisis in Venezuela, allusions to 18th-century literature. I feel like Stefan here. It's got everything. Jessica Yellen, stick around. We want you folks to stick around as well. Where do you go to slake your thirst for political coverage? What do you see when you turn on TV news? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing TV news in the digital era, journalism in the time of Snapchat, and truth in the age of Trump. You can join our conversation. What do you value about TV news? What drives you nuts? What distinctions do you make among channels or different kinds of news, if any? Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. No one better to talk to about all this than Jessica Yellen, a former chief White House correspondent for CNN, who also work at MSNBC and at ABC News. Her new book, Savage News, is a fictional expose about the trials and tribulations of an ambitious female reporter at a major cable news network. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I want to start with a second reading. It's we've titled it Mole for specific reasons. In this season, Natalie Savage gets a scoop. She figures out that, if I'm remembering this correctly, a picture makes headlines has been doctored because it shows a mole on the First Lady's neck. She knows the First Lady had that mole removed, and Natalie figures there's intrigue afoot. Walk us through this scene.
Okay. After checking her eyelashes one last time, Natalie put down the mirror and walked over to the desk. I still don't get it, one of the what girls at the desk, who had been squinting at Natalie's producer, Matt, shifted the squint to Natalie. A mole? I mean, who else is reporting that? Does, like, the New York Times or Beltway have it? Natalie frowned and looked at Matt, who looked back at her with an expression of humility she wouldn't have guessed he possessed. You try, he said. I'm completely defeated, and walked off, leaving Natalie on her own. With a deep breath, Natalie steeled herself and explained, no, no one else was reporting about the mole. We have it first, she said, flooding her voice with enthusiasm. The what girl frowned, unmoved. I don't understand. If no one else is reporting it, how do you know it's true?
The what girl being the gatekeepers to getting on air and being able to say something. How dominant was that actually in the news business? That is, the doubting of news television news organizations that they had the ability to report things on their own authority.
So it was so commonplace. You'd scramble to try to break something, even something small, and then people would truly say to you, well, I can't find it in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Herald, so, like, why are we comfortable with this? And you say, it's my information. I reported it through journalism. And so
let me tell you about it. It's called reporting.
So I thought that was a TV thing, but I've been talking to friends of mine who now read the book who are print reporters, and they're like, oh, no. Happens to us too all the time. There's this fundamental discomfort you have with sometimes being first. On the one hand, you want to break something. On the other hand, scary to be out on a ledge on your own.
And we found that in a lot of the Trump reporting. You don't want to be out and alone too long.
Right.
Right. But at the same time, you would think you want to be first. That's drummed into you. We've got a call from Mike. He's calling from Granbury, Connecticut for Jessica Yellen. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes. Hi. A while back, there was a news bit, I think it was originated from BizNews, about Cohen claiming that Trump told him to lie. And I got very frustrated because the major news networks would start their reporting of this by saying, we have not confirmed this. Mm-hmm. And then they would go ahead and do it. And so basically what they were doing was passing on gossip.
And I find
that frustrating. I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
Oh, I find that frustrating with all these claims about fake news, which are troublesome, that sort of perpetuates it.
So, Mike, I just want to be clear, and I think I mispronounced it. I think it's Granby, Connecticut. Forgive me. But you're talking about Michael Cohen, the president's former private lawyer, and maybe was it a story from BuzzFeed News?
That's what it was. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. Just want to clarify it. I want Jessica Yellen to be able to respond to you. Thank you so much for the question. Talk to us about that. When particularly live news, and to be fair, NBC now has MSNBC as it has for 20 plus years, but CBS now has CBSN, its digital platform. The old networks are no longer just a few hours a day. What do you make of it when news is recycled and folks say, we haven't been able to confirm it, but here's what somebody else has said?
This is one of the very challenging dilemmas of our moment. I think on the one hand, we have not seen such high quality journalism in our lifetimes. It's exceptional what journalists are doing right now. I applaud my former colleagues. So the practice of journalism is alive and flourishing. At the same time, many journalists are working inside organizations that have to fill endless hours of airtime. And one of the ways they do that is by grabbing other people's reporting and building on it. And sometimes in the race to fill airtime, you grab reporting that you haven't verified at all. And it's sort of a convention of the way news works now, but it's not something that it doesn't always live up to the test of what we really should be doing. And I think in that case, we saw just a bunch of organizations rush because there's some kernel of truth to what BuzzFeed did report. It's the specifics of how they reported it seems, like the very details of that report that are being questioned. And so everybody's rushing with this stuff, and we need to all slow down a beat.
Mm-hmm. NPR occasionally does that as well, but it's one of these things where you're balancing the importance of the news being offered, the credibility of the outlet, and then the reluctance to do stuff. At times, NPR, I find, and I can tell you because I see the internal chatter, is very it tends to be slower. But, NPR doesn't have four other live national radio outlets that are seen as – even though we're competing with the BBC and ABC and New York Times and everybody else instantly. Nonetheless, you know, we don't think of it that way, and maybe that makes it a little easier.
I think NPR is exceptional at this. I think that NPR moves carefully, is cautious, tells you the news when it's important and when you need it. And I think, you know, the rest of the world of news often thinks that that loses, you know, it doesn't move fast enough. People want quick. No, people want information told clearly and calmly. And I think this is the model for how to do it.
You know, you're one of your old employers, your last old full-time employer, CNN, presents itself as sort of, you know, we're not the left like MSNBC. We're not the right. We are standing up for journalism, capital J. So let's go to a memorable exchange, far from the only one, but a memorable exchange of your most recent successor, Jim Acosta. He got involved in a heated exchange with President Trump last November, just after the midterm elections, you may recall. Acosta challenged the president on the claim that a caravan of migrants was approaching the southern border with an intent to invade the U.S.
They're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question, Mr. President, are you worried?
That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks. Pardon me, ma'am.
Excuse me, that's enough.
Later in the day, the president and the White House suspended Acosta's White House credentials. That's the badge that basically gets him in on a permanent basis. The White House claimed he had jostled a young aide, though footage seemed to strongly disprove that. The following week, a federal judge granted CNN's request to reinstate Acosta's White House press pass. What do you make of CNN's sort of combative Big J approach to handling this particular White House?
Well, I'll say this. I think that you notice that Jim in that exchange was going really hard at the president on a legitimate issue about the caravan. And he was really making a defensible point that needed to be made. And the president definitely changed the topic to combat with the media. Mm-hmm. And I think the president uses the media as a useful opponent in a kind of WWE scenario when he wants to get out of tough situations, change the topic to, you know, attacking the media and wait for the media to take the bait. And I think it puts the media in a really challenging position because you can't let that go. You have to respond, but you also don't want to feed that drama and take away from the news of the day, the real stories. And it's a challenge. I don't know what the solution is. I think that it's something we need to talk about. I think that, you know, Jim is in a high pressure situation and he is doing what he can to hold the president's feet to the fire. And then the president changes the topic to his network. It's an obvious game that the president's playing. So what is the right solution? I don't know.
So, you know, in your book, Natalie is essentially competing. I don't think it gives too much away.
It's fairly early on.
Yeah, yeah. For a White House job, a top White House reporting job, with a guy who had been on a reality show and at one point takes off his, you know, his T-shirt to reveal a 24-pack or something of abs, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you talk about authenticity and the idea of that really standing in for shtick. You know, conservative friends of mine, some press critics look at Jim Acosta and say his shtick is to be sort of the human microphone and be in kind of rhetorical combat with the president, addressing substantive issues like the question of immigration, but really using that to elevate his profile on CNN's. How fair is that as a critique?
I mean, I can't speak to Jim's motives. I think that he's there every day trying to, you know, be tough on the White House. I think that he is sort of, I think of Sam Donaldson and how Sam Donaldson did the job back in the day. And people didn't like the way that Sam yelled. You know, when Reagan was president, everybody was sort of polite and you asked questions when asked to ask a question, and Sam Donaldson would shout it out. And that seemed to be rude at the time. And so I think there's a version of Jim an explanation for Jim's style is a bit like that. And it's getting in the president's face. And for me, all of that is fine. The challenge is, and this is not particular to CNN, it's in general, how do you get out of this debate with the president about the legitimacy of the press? How do we stop having that conversation and constantly redirect him to whatever it is, the caravan, healthcare, your relationship with the Senate, period?
You know, I thought of Sam Donaldson the other day, former Democratic South Carolina Senator Fritz Hollings died. Mm-hmm. And in his obituary, you know, there was a guy who also at times played combat with the press, right? So they recounted a scene, forgive me, Sam, but where they're on a live TV set together and he's pushing Hollings on his support for textiles, basically tariffs against external importers of cloth and fabric. And Donaldson says, well, where did you get your suit, Senator? And Hollings said, I don't know, maybe the same place you got your toupee.
Oh, no. That's so mean.
A brutal, brutal moment. You know, look, you worked so hard to get in, you know, to national level. Yeah. So hard. You really are fascinated by politics and policy. You care about this stuff. You thought, I'm reaching the biggest audience. I'm on CNN. I am the chief White House correspondent. This thing that Natalie Savage thinks that she wants. Why did you walk away? Why'd you leave?
You know, I left for a lot of reasons. I always wanted to be chief White House correspondent, and I was covered the White House twice. I got it. I got there and I ended up in a place where I had three Blackberries and no social life. And I felt like I'd done what I could do. And I wanted a new challenge. I needed to change. And I needed to do the news. Like, I wanted to figure out if there was another way to tell the news. And it was just the right choice for me as part as like a woman and as a reporter who'd like accomplished that goal. And then I went off and I did research into how people consume the news and what else they might want. And is there another way to tell the news? And I've kind of found that there is. And I have a theory on that that I wanted to explore. And that's what I've done since then, other than this book.
Want to take a couple of calls? People okay. Interested, fans, media critics, the like. We've got folks. Jeremy is calling from Columbus, Georgia. Jeremy, go right ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, nowadays, cable does not seem to have a lot of gravitas or information density when you listen to it. If you listen to an NPR report in the morning, it just seems very serious, and there's a lot of information in short time. And, you know, cable news has all this time to fill, but I feel like I get a lot less data when I actually spend 10 minutes watching it. I just wonder why that seems to happen.
Thanks for your call and your thoughts on that, Jeremy. We did notice new day anchors this morning. They're good anchors, but they were shown this morning getting acupuncture treatments on the air. You know, anything wrong with that?
I mean, it's morning news. It is what it is. You wake up with them. They're a family. You have fun. First of all, I should say this is why I love my time when I've been here with WBUR and On Point, and I love this whole team. And hello to everybody back in Boston, if I can do that shout out. I love them. Hi, Karen. You know, one of the things I found about the news in general is when you have to fill that much airtime, and just the conventions of news have turned into making politics sports, which means that the way it's covered is about outrage and competition and jargon. And it's these panels of people yelling at each other too often without first explaining the fundamental issues. It's like, give us a minute and a half on what the thing is, whether it's the tax plan or the new border policy or what Trump wants to do with healthcare. Then you can fight about it if you want.
I mean, it's look, there's good anchors and hosts and reporters, a lot of good reporters on cable. I mean, I think the morning hosts actually, you know, Allison Camerota and John Berman, I think, are terrifically smart. Jake Tapper does a really good job holding people to account. But there's so many good reporters on places like CNN who I feel like don't get the time to actually tell the stories. Like, they're being paid. Why are we not seeing more from them?
Well, I feel like sometimes it's like racehorses who could be let to run. And instead, they're being held too far back in their whatever you call them stalls. It's like there is exceptional journalism that is being done, and you see it at all these organizations online and sometimes on the air, often on the air. But too much of it is these pundits yelling. And the thing that I've learned is, you know, the management believes that that's what the audience wants. I have done research that shows there is a huge audience that doesn't want that. They want news told clearly, calmly, and with substance, and then get out. Let them have their day, right? Mm-hmm. Keep it simple. Keep it clean. Don't scream.
And we'll talk a little bit about your venture, News Not Noise, after this break. I want to briefly take a call from Stowe, Vermont. Dan, go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Good. Thanks. This is such a great topic, so I appreciate the dialogue on this. Jessica, it's a fantastic story. I look forward to the book. So I've changed my. I'm a news junkie, and I watch all the networks, and painfully some of them. But I've changed my watch. I listen to NPR. I go to Vice now, and to some extent, I used to watch Al Jazeera News. I watch the BBC. So I have shifted all of my news intake because of all the things you're talking about. But the topic I really wanted to ask you about and just get your feedback off the air on, I guess, is the for-profit media, if you will, and the fact that the journalists, quote-unquote journalists, at a lot of the major news outlets, Fox and CNN, MSNBC, are getting paid in the millions of dollars, and they become celebrities. And I think that has such an impact on driving ratings, and the ratings pay, the commercials pay for their salaries, and it's sort of cyclical nightmare that we get ourselves into. And I wanted to know, maybe it's in your book, but how much of that you think is affecting it, and what can we do to change that dynamic?
So, Jessica Yellen, thank you so much, Dan. Jessica Yellen, give us a taste, and we'll come back after the break.
You have to remember, these businesses are for-profit businesses, and a lot of their decisions are based on getting ratings and making bank.
We've been taking a look behind the scenes of the drama that is political journalism in Washington. Join our conversations. What question do you have for longtime TV journalist Jessica Yellen? How is the news changing? In what ways do you think the attacks have affected it? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing TV news with someone who knows the score. She's taking a look under the hood at the substance and superficiality of covering politics in Washington for a major news network. How pervasive is the sexism? How is the news defined? Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, Jessica Yellen, former chief White House correspondent at CNN, the author of the new satiric novel, Savage News.
You say that so well.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to practice it. Okay. I mean, I guess you've already probably voiced your own audiobook, but if you need. So we had a caller in, Dan, I believe it was, calling from Vermont, and he was talking a little bit about the celebrity and the drive for sort of ratings, entertainment, and attention. We have a clip. We have a clip. Election night, 2008. Set yourself back in time. Was it historic in memorable ways? It was. It was a big day in Chicago, but not historic only for the ways you think. It also marked the first time CNN experimented with a new hologram technology, beaming Jessica Yellen's image virtually from Chicago, where she was covering the Obama campaign, into CNN's main studios to report back to anchor Wolf Blitzer.
You're the first one that we've beamed in to the CNN Election Center.
I know, it's like I follow in the tradition of Princess Leia. It's something else. It's the first time it's been live on television, and it's a remarkable setup, if I could tell you about it for a moment. I'm inside a tent in Chicago that's been built. Engineers spent about 3 weeks doing it. There are 35 high-definition cameras ringing me in a ring around me. I'm in the center, and they shoot my body at different angles, and I'm told that transmits what looks like an entire body image back there to New York.
So just so listeners know, I know, you were closing your eyes, you were smiling, and you were shaking your head.
First of all, this feels like a This Is Your Life episode. Amazing.
It's surprising. We have 11 of your Girl Scout pack members going to come out in third
Okay, I'm
day.
Ready.
Yeah. So look, this is shtick. This is showbiz. The execs, David Borman, I think the Washington bureau chief at the time for CNN, loved the gizmos, right?
A lot of gizmos that year.
So how do you process that out-of-body surround-camera experience?
Well, first of all, I have to say, so we'd spent, I can't remember, was it 16 months covering the most intense up to that point campaign, nonstop, on the road, you know, 20-hour days. And then election day, all of a sudden, comes to a grinding halt. And they say to me, because there's nothing to cover while people are voting, and they say to me, we have this funny thing, we're going to try doing this high-tech beaming thing. You want to come into the tent and play around. And I'm like, okay, that sounds fun for a change. And we spent the whole day doing, not the whole day, we spent some hours doing like mime, like trying to see if it would work. And I couldn't see what viewers at home could see. So when I'm saying, I think you can see a 3D image of me, I didn't know. I'll tell you that after that, I got all these emails from scientists saying, you did not use three wave diffraction to create a 3D image. Therefore, it was not a hologram. It was a tautogram. So officially, I was the first tautogram on network news.
You know, anytime you can get a tautology about a tautogram, you're doing something. So like Natalie Savage sort of in her book, I'm not giving away any endings or any key plot points, but nonetheless, you know, she takes stock of her career, shall we say. You look back and that, is it a great fun? Is it a lark? Are you asking yourself, why the heck is that part of something that has the word news in it? Yeah. Is it perfectly fine? You're exploring boundaries of different ways to tell stories.
I actually think in this case, and I know I'm in the minority, I think it's fine. I think it's not, you know, technology should be introduced into the news and it's helping us gather news. And it should be used to advance how we, you know, the intake. But it should be used to help tell the story. And so in that case, one of the confusing things is the whole world wanted to be in Grant Park. That's where Obama was about to get elected. But they were taking a human in Grant Park and beaming her into a studio. And so it was like a silly inversion of what is the ideal use of technology. On the other hand, it was fun. It's silly. And, you know, if you're going to play with video, it's a visual medium. Who cares?
I'd like to take a couple calls now. We've got a call from Boston, Massachusetts. Erica, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Jessica. My concerning question is for you. I'm a freelance journalist. I just had my first piece published just yesterday with Essence Magazine, where I covered a small political election. Thank you. I covered a small political election in Jamaica, where the first time a woman took the seat in that area. My question to you is, where do you think we are in terms of international coverage, whether it's politics or feature stories, it just in mainstream news, because it just appears that for years now, we're not getting those international stories that I think people want to see. And we're just not getting that, at least on, you know, mainstream CNN and then, you know, with the NBCs and ABCs. What are your thoughts on our coverage or lack thereof of international news?
I agree with you. And I'll tell you, I do this thing we'll talk about on Instagram where I report the news on Instagram. And I hear from the audience a lot that they'd like to hear more international news. And there is two things that are going on. One is the networks are so all Trump all the time that nothing is breaking through. It's not whether it's national or international. It's just they're all trained on the White House and on pundits in the building. And then two, there has been this assumption inside the business for some time that American audiences don't want that much international news. And I think Vice came along and disrupted that and proved, you know, there's plenty of audience for international news and actually millennials want it. And so I think Vice is demonstrating that and more independent media is where you have to go to get that right now. NPR does some international coverage. CNN International is a great source. But I agree that there is a larger audience for what you're talking about than the networks necessarily acknowledge.
I'd like to take a call now from Montreal. Chris, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Kind of a multi-part question here that piggybacks on the last one. I was just curious about, like, in today's world, things are becoming more and more polarized, and more journalism is inflammatory or provocative and can be seen as almost propaganda. And this is coming from both sides, both Democrat and Republican. And so my question is, how do we balance free speech with, like, I guess, journalistic constrictions? Or how do we balance free speech when people are, you know, advising for hate between communities? And what role does the government play in this? And what role do we play as consumers in this?
And Chris, just before you, I relinquish you, do you mean specifically on social media, people calling for things and, you know, conversations on Reddit or videos loaded to YouTube? Or do you mean, you know, in some ways the more fractious elements of, you know, of cable news or the Alex Joneses of the world?
I think in my mind, when I was thinking of the question, I was thinking more of like the Alex Jones scenario. But I mean, obviously, social media is an important aspect as well.
All right, Chris, thank you so much for that call. Jessica Yellen, proof that not only is it restricted to White House reporters to ask multi-part questions.
Yeah.
tell us a little bit about your thought about, you know, the role of, in some ways, corralling more extreme speech, or whether that tramples on the ability for all of us to take part.
I think it's incumbent on journalists to be able to call out what is and isn't true and truthful in what other people are reporting on the fringes, and then let it go. At some point, you and the audience have a responsibility to inform yourself about what is real, legitimate journalism and what is, you know, outrage, opinion, entertainment style, you know, talk. And I don't actually think it's as confusing as we all make it. We are all very – we have found tribes. That's the universe we're living in right now. Things are more polarized. But just within that, be aware of what your tribe is and try to correct for it a little bit. If you know you're on the left, every so often dip into something on the right and vice versa.
I want to talk to you. I'd seen you mention in past – well, look, in the book – as apparently in the headlines, sexual harassment is rife, right? Yeah. So we've seen Charlie Rose at CBS, Matt Lauer at NBC, seemingly the top leadership of Fox News, but certainly Roger Ailes before his death tossed out, and it seemed as though that was a deep cultural issue there. In your book, it is rife with sexual harassment, and yet you wrote – I saw in one interview you gave that you said, you know, people told me to take it out. It was too purple. They just didn't buy it.
Yeah. So there's two things. One is so I started writing the book at the end of 2014 into 2015, well before the Harvey Weinstein thing happened, which is in 2017. And I had what I call light Me Too. None of what happens in the book is overt aggressive assault or anything. It's just the kind of inappropriate comments, sometimes creepy behavior that someone in the office is inflicting on a lot of different women, and nobody knows how to deal with it, so it just continues. And this is something I think a lot of women have to deal with, because you don't want to report that guy. You don't want him to lose his job, but you also want it to stop. And so I wanted to sort of tease this out. And my early readers, my friends, were like, all of that, take it out. Nobody wants to read that. Some said it's not plausible. Then the Harvey Weinstein thing happens, and I get all these calls and emails from people going, put it back in, put it back in.
Mm-hmm.
Because our culture shifted, and the shift is not that this wasn't happening before. It's just that we weren't allowed to talk about it, and now we are.
Is there something specific about TV news that enables that? I've certainly written about people in print world. Certainly one of our top executives was dismissed for related issues. But the question is is there something about TV news that allows this to be particularly pervasive?
I honestly don't know. I've had this conversation a lot because I live in LA now. And so the conversation they have is this specific to the media? Because it's a lot Hollywood and all media businesses. And I've only worked in the media, so I'm not sure. It is possible. Maybe we're just more talkative. And once we do something, we broadcast it. And folks who are working in corporate America in the middle of the country can't talk about it.
So Gretchen Carlson knows how to use a microphone.
Yes.
And that encourages other people to come forward because they know how to use the media.
Yes. On the other hand, it is striking that this was going on for so very many years, and it was allowed to continue, and the news never talked about it. Like, the news were in the business of covering other people's foibles but never pointing out our own.
It seems to me as though there's a combination in some ways of the power and influence that even just sort of rote decisions have about people's careers. I can send you to Washington. I can send you to Baghdad. And also the ambition that you describe in Natalie Savage reflected in so many TV reporters, because it's a combination of journalistic passion and a hunger for fame.
Right.
So I want to turn to your venture. Your own thing, reflected in at least elements of the book. But nonetheless, you decided to take to Instagram. You're like, look, I don't have to be hired by somebody to talk about the news, and I don't have to break the news to talk about the news. You went with News Not Noise, a venture you began last year to inform viewers about current events told differently than you might find it on traditional media. Here's, you could call it a newscast from your page from earlier this month, in which you sought to break down President Trump's moves in backing down from his threat to close off the border with Mexico.
Remember last week, the president said that he'd close the southern border if Mexico didn't stop all illegal immigration to the U.S. I said, that's not likely to happen. Well, today he walked it back. He said, okay, he won't close the southern border after all, but he still could if he wanted to. He also said that he could resolve the problems in our immigration system in 45 minutes if it were all up to him.
You're laughing.
Oh, my God. It's so...
Sadly, Jessica Yellen, not a hologram or a tautogram or any other kind of – I guess she's an Instagram at this point. So what are your people coming on board? What are they finding there they can't find anywhere else? What are you trying to do?
I believe there's a audience that wants news told succinct, clear, and calm. A big piece of it is calm. And so what I'm doing is offering to an audience that's on Instagram the top news of the day explained in not a lot of time without any panic. I call it news without a panic attack. And the idea of news not noise is in the news landscape, there's a ton of information coming at you. Everything's a mountain. Nothing's a molehill the way they cover it. And it's very hard if you don't live and breathe news to decipher what really matters. And I'm a news obsessive, so I can tell you. And so what I do is I say, here's what's happening in the world that's getting coverage. These three stories, they're noise. You can read about them. You can learn about them. They're not going to matter long term or to your life. This story over here is the one that really matters. Let me explain to you what it means, why, and let you be done.
So I've noticed that you have friends from the journalism world, friends from celebrities drop in. Amy Schumer, I think A-Rod, you know, came in at one point. I don't quite understand how that was brokered, but, you know, something to do with Miami, no doubt. What are your aspirations for this?
It's a good question. So I'd like to turn this into a business. I'd like to actually do this full time and bring in other reporters and be able to give people the news distilled that matters without a panic attack. And I think it can be done digitally to your phone, and it can be short. And this is a way to sort of free you of notifications all day and Twitter alerts and the panic that you get every time a breaking news thing flashes in front of your face. If you want to be able to turn that off, I'd like to offer a place where you can just, we gotcha. We're going to give you just enough, just what you need on your phone.
And in the last minute we have, in some ways this strikes me as the anti-Fox News, not by ideology. You're not, you know, reading aloud editorials from The Nation magazine or something, but that it's calm, it's not panicking, and it's strictly factual.
It's fact-based, yes. We have data and show our sources.
You know, one of the things that's amazing is the implication of there being this closed loop with the president. There's been this pushback. The media scholar Mike Sokolow said, you know, only 2.5 million, 3 million people are watching any one moment. How important is Fox at this moment? Is it overblown, or is it really kind of affecting our understanding of our society and the way in which our government is governed?
I think it's hugely influential, not just with its audience, but because our president watches it so obsessively. And because while there are real journalists doing practicing journalism inside Fox, but they get shouted down by these opinion people. And it's having a really upsetting effect on the media in this country right now.
Some of them practicing good journalism, some of them hoping to get the chance to practice some good journalism. Exactly. You've been listening to Jessica Yellen, former CNN chief White House correspondent, author of Savage News. She is the founder of News Not Noise, although she advises her doppelganger in the book Savage News, Natalie Savage, to be noisy. Jessica Yellen, thank you as ever for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. You can follow me at Jessica Yellen on Instagram.
Hey, that's cool. You can continue the conversation and follow us on our website, onpointradio.org. Get our podcast, sign up for our newsletter, or follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point, produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Adam Waller, with help from Matt Hoisch, Alex Pena, and Sydney Wertheim, the hardest working team in On Point News, anyway. Our executive producer, Karen Schiffman, a big fan of yours. I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.